Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo 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 Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Iti.
Thus.
Mimamsata.
Mimamsata.
While deliberating.
Because
the Lord Brahma and the great sages such as Marichi, four Kumaras and Manu, they were all wondering who this great creature was. And they were expressing their thoughts on it. So that, thus they were deliberating. So that's Iti Mamam Satas Tasya. His Brahmana.
Brahmana.
Of Brahma. Saha. Along with.
Along with.
Sunibhi.
Sunibhi.
His sons. So Brahma. Brahma and all his sons, because all these great sages were the sons of Lord Brahma. So they were all deliberating, trying to understand the identity of the Supreme Lord, who he was, who this great figure was, who came from the nostril of all places of Lord Brahma. And he was so small and bhushto, he was the size of the top part of the thumb, and then suddenly he grew to the size of an elephant. And naturally, the great sages were wondering about the identity of this entity. And Lord Brahma, as we heard in the last verse that we read yesterday, he was thinking, he was wondering, is this the Supreme Lord? Because he had just prayed. Because he was in a situation that was beyond his capacity to solve. The earth had fallen into the Gobadak ocean, and it was beyond his ability to elevate the earth again, even though he was the creator, even though he was so powerful. It was beyond his ability. So what did he do in that case? We spoke about that verse yesterday, and it was spoken about the day before. What did Brahma do when he was confronted with a situation that was beyond his ability to solve? What did he do? Well, just raise your hand and say it. He prayed to the Supreme Lord. So in Brahma's example is an example for us to follow. Sometimes life can appear so complex, we don't know how to deal with a particular issue. So, of course, we have to use our intelligence and be as practical. But ultimately, we have to follow the example of Brahma. And he took shelter of the Supreme Lord because he understood clearly that without Krishna's sanction, even if I could lift it myself, without Krishna giving me the power to lift it myself, there's no question of success. Because everything ultimately depends on Krishna. And seeing Krishna's hand in all things is Krishna consciousness. What's a verse in the Bhagavad Gita that says, I'll give you a hint, Yomam, but say it. Yomam pashyati sarvatra savam. Satchamena pranashyati. So for one who sees me everywhere and sees everything in me, for him I am never lost. Nor is he ever lost to me. Because Krishna is thinking about the devotees who are calling out to him. those who are calling him out to him continuously, Krishna will continuously think of them. Even Ajamil, he called out to Narayana. His son was named Narayana. But actually, although his son's name was Narayana, his son was named after Narayana. So actually, he was calling out the name of the Supreme Lord. And how does Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, how does he react when someone is deeply calling out to him, or not deeply exactly, but sincerely calling out to him with all sincerity, without taking shelter of him? So in the verse in the sixth canto, Nama Viharan Vishnu, beginning with that, it says that the Lord, he thinks, he is calling out to me, my devotee is calling out to me. It is my duty to protect him. It is my obligation, it is part of the relationship to protect him. So that's Krishna's mood, and this is when Ajamil was calling out just to the name of his son. So that's how Krishna took it. So this is the Lord we are developing our relationship with. So Brahma, when not knowing what to do, immediately, Lord Varaha came to protect him, or Krishna came in the form of Varaha to protect him. Because he had promised Lord Brahma that there would be no time you will be bewildered, you will be in difficulty. So this, a few times Brahma gets into difficulty in one sense. One time, this is one occurrence, and then in another instance that's described in the 11th canto, where his sons, the four Kumaras, they ask him a question that he can't answer. And we won't go into that one, but they ask him a very, very, very difficult question. And then immediately, because he couldn't answer it, immediately the Hamsavatar came to help him, to assist him, and answer the very question that the four Kumaras asked. So this is the nature of the relationship between the Lord and his devotees. The devotees give their heart to Krishna, and they give everything to Krishna, and Krishna reciprocates by giving everything to them. And there's that amazing pastime in the 10th canto, in the 80th and 81st chapter. Does anyone know the 80th and 81st chapter of the 10th canto? Without using our artificial memories? Huh? Yes, someone said it. Sudama. Yes, Sudama Brahmana. That when Sudama begged, he wanted to go to see Krishna. He thought, I can't go without offering him anything. But I'm in a very difficult situation. We can't even imagine how poverty-stricken he was, that he had nothing in his house that he could offer Krishna. So he went to one of his neighbors and he begged some chipped rice. Is anyone here from Porbandar? Has anyone been to Sudama's house? Very nice. So he went to his neighbor and he begged something. He begged something, and what his neighbor gave him was very, very insignificant. And it was certainly, it is the food of a poverty-stricken person. It is the food of a beggar. It is a food that sometimes sadhus will travel when they're traveling and they have nothing else to eat. They'll have their chipped rice. Just add some water, at least they can eat something. So after he saw Krishna, Krishna asked him, "You must have brought me something. What is it?" And he was thinking, "No, how can I give this to Krishna?" He was the king of Dwarka. He was living in such opulence. And the goddess of fortune herself, Rukmini Devi, was serving him. And he was holding back, giving this tipped rice, this flattened rice, to Krishna. Krishna forcibly grabbed it. And he took a morsel. And he was about to take more, and when Rukmini Devi stopped him. So Sudama had come there. The external reason for him going there, was what he wanted to, his wife had requested him to beg something from Krishna so their poverty could be lessened. But Sudama didn't ask Krishna for anything when he was there. He was so satisfied just seeing Krishna, and such a devotee didn't want to ask anything on that level. And Krishna didn't mention anything. And Sudama left, not having asked Krishna for anything, nor had Krishna offered him anything. And our acharyas, and then later on, we know that Sudama walked into his previous place, and it was completely opulent. It was more opulence than a king would possess, a heavenly king. So the question is asked: why is it that Krishna didn't say anything? We can understand why Sudama didn't say anything. But if Krishna was going to offer this great opulence to Sudama, why didn't he say, "Don't worry, everything will be taken care of. Let your anxiety, let your family's anxiety be relieved." So the question is this: why didn't Krishna say anything? And the answer is given by one of the acharyas, is that Krishna was very embarrassed. Because yeyetamam prapadyante, he reciprocates according to the degree of, according to the mood and the degree that something is given to him. And Krishna was thinking that Sudama, being that he knows everything, Sudama didn't have anything, didn't own anything. He didn't give what he had to me. But rather, he went outside and begged it. And he gave something that was more than what he has. So Krishna was thinking, this is a very difficult situation for me because everything is mine. So how am I going to give him in an equal way, as I have promised, more than what I have? He was thinking that what I'm giving him, this incredible opulence, is not an equal reciprocation with what he's given me. So therefore, he felt very, very, very shy, very embarrassed by his inability. So he didn't say anything. So we hear these pastimes of Krishna, and we'll continue to hear more about Krishna, but not... we're hearing about Krishna here, but in his form as a Leela avatar. This is a pastime incarnation, as Prabhupada generally will translate Leela avatar. This is a form of Krishna, a mood of Krishna, in that he's performing an activity. Why don't we call the activities of Krishna pastimes or Leelas? Because to differentiate them from the particular activities that we do in this world, which are the engine that's driving our activities, unless we are driven by devotion. But in this world, people are generally driven by the mode of
passion, the mode of ignorance, and occasionally there may be someone sometime who has a little bit of a tinge of sattva-gun in them. But there's something driving us, and the forces that drive us, this is called Maya, Krishna's Maya Shakti in the three forms. Goodness, passion, and ignorance, they're actually forces, energies of Krishna, or Krishna's external energy, Maya Shakti, that is driving everyone to act the way they do. We have another term, a conditioned living entity. That means that these forces, according to one's karma, these three modes of material nature are pushing, driving one to act. So they're conditioned by these forces. And these forces, these three modes of material nature, amazingly enough, they don't have anything at all to do with us. We say we're not our body, we're not our mind, we're not our conditioned nature. We are something different than that. We are Krishna's servant. Mama eva amsa jiva loke jiva. We are Krishna's. This is who we are. Even to say that we are eternal souls, we're eternal. If you visit Mayavad land, you'll see above their altars, Aham Brahmasmi. You are Brahma. You are the supreme, or you are. But it's true that we are qualitatively the supreme. The same substance, like the sun rays, are the same substance of the sun. But that is not all of who we are. We are also, to complete who we understand that we are Krishna's. Eva Amsa, Krishna's part in the parcel. Jiva Sanatana, eternally. This is who we are. We belong. We belong to someone. We belong to Krishna. And our relationship with him is that we are meant to serve him. And if we, Krishna Bhule Se Jeev, if we turn our back on serving Krishna, we don't turn our back on serving. We end up serving anyway. It's unavoidable because it's our constitutional nature. We are servants. Have you noticed that? That no matter how hard I try to become a master and control things for my pleasure, I end up serving more and more and more. You want to control a country, even, and you end up serving all the people in the country, and you have to take the politicians nowadays, they must take polls all the time to find out what the people are actually thinking, so that then they can make bold statements that agrees with what everyone is thinking, and everyone think, oh, he's very wise. And they make policies based on what people are thinking. So you end up having to serve all those people. People get dogs because they want at least someone will like me if I feed them. And you end up having to serve the dog. So, serve Krishna. This is the essential message that Srila Prabhupada gave us to tell people. Become a servant of Krishna. You have to serve, but serve that person who, in his dealings with Sudama, felt embarrassed that he couldn't reciprocate properly with the gift of some chitra. Serve Krishna, that person who amazingly enough took the form of a boar, Varaha, when Brahma, was in difficulty. It was service to Brahma that he came. We don't want to serve Krishna, but we end up serving anyway. But Krishna wants to serve. His pleasure is serving the devotees. So if we can chant Krishna's names and practice Krishna consciousness in a sincere and serious way, then we will understand very, very deeply these truths. That we are Krishnas. And when we understand that we are Krishnas, then we will also understand that Krishna is mine. And in this world, we aim for understanding that we are Krishna. But in Goloka Vrindavan, in Vrindavan, the residents of Vrindavan, their emphasis is not on we are Krishnas, but it is mamata. Krishna is mine. Their relationship with him is so sweet. They're just thinking, he is ours. He is our village boy. We are from the same village. And in those days, growing up in the same village was like growing up in the same house as someone. You see them every day. You know them so well. So the relationship with Krishna can be so intimate. So intimate. If one is pure enough, or selfless enough, but not we don't have a self, but not a selfish self. If we learn to love Krishna, if we learn to love Sri Sri Radha Balava, then our life is perfect. And we look at Sri Sri Radha Balava and they're so lovely. They're so beautiful. They're so beautiful. I don't think it's possible to be in a bad mood if you look at Jagannath Baladev and Subhadra Devi. So when you're in a bad mood, just come and just look at them and tell them and just look at them. And they say, don't take it so seriously. It's very temporary. You're eternal. This is just some karma that you have, and just accept it, and don't make believe you're innocent, as if you never did anything wrong. And why is that? I don't know why they've done this to me. Look at Radha Balava. Everyone, just look at Radha Balava. I'm the only one who can't see Radha Balava. So charming, so opulent, so attractive. So it takes energy not to be attracted to the all attractive. We have to deliberately, Krishna Mule is saying, we have to turn our back on Krishna not to be attracted to him. It's so beautiful, unlimitedly beautiful. How beautiful is unlimitedly beautiful? And with Radha Balava, the more we... Oh, no. According, they can reveal, even though we say they are deities, but they can reveal themselves completely to you. They can reveal their unlimited beauty to you. Unlimited beauty. Radha Balava could reveal that to you according if they so desire. According to how we approach them. They reveal if we approach with great devotion, with great love. Devotion means love. Then and they can reveal themselves completely, or they will reveal themselves completely. Okay, now I have to confront the fact that I might not have gotten through the word by words yet. What were we up to?
About two sons.
Oh, yes. Okay. So, Brahmana Sahaj Srinivi, that with the sons, with his sons, they were deliberating, Brahma with his sons, the great sages, were deliberating upon the identity of this great entity. And then Bhagavan, the personality of Godhead, Yajna, Lord Vishnu, Purushaha,
the Supreme Person,
Jagarja,
Jagarja,
resounded. He made a great, great sound. Aga Indra,
great mountain,
Saniba,
like.
So he made a sound as they were deliberating upon him. Bhagavan Jagyapurusha, the Supreme Lord, who's he's called Jagyapurusha here, the Supreme Lord. But it means also he is the person who is the one who, when a sacrifice, a Vedic sacrifice is made, he is the one who receives that sacrifice. It is meant to, for his pleasure. All sacrifices are meant for his pleasure. So that person, so what shastra, where are the sacrifices? They are written in the Vedas. And the Vedas are instructive scriptures to teach how to please the Lord. And of course, therefore, they end in bhakti. So, he is the object of the Vedas as the Jagyapurusha, and he is the Vedas personified in that sense, because he is the object of the Vedas. So how interesting it is that the Vedas, which are not of this world, that are completely pure, and it takes pure consciousness, it takes Brahmanism, pure consciousness, to actually perform the Vedic rites. Not just anyone can perform them. Qualified Brahmanas perform them. That means in sattva-gun, at least in sattva-gun, in the mode of goodness, one's consciousness is very clear and pure. And the Vedic rites are meant to please Jagya Vai Purusha, Vai Vishnu, are meant to please Vishnu. And what form is Vishnu in? The most pure things are meant to please this most pure person, and he's in the form of a boar, a hog. Now, if you've ever seen, gone to, we'll say, Vrindavan, and you've seen the local hog residence, one would think that a hog, or commonly known as a pig, is the least pure. When in the places where there are open sewers, the hogs go into the open sewers in the hot season. Has anyone ever observed this wonderful fact? They go in the sewers that are filled with things that we won't even talk or think about at this particular moment. And they're in there, and they're, we call this pig heaven. And they're so happy in pig heaven. And then when they get out, they... If you happen to be walking nearby, you will run from them. So these most dirty creatures, filthy, dirty creatures, but when Krishna is in a form like that, he's the object of pure worship.
So whatever form Krishna is in, again going to the same point, that it is transcendental. It is transcendental. It is supremely pure. It is eternity, bliss and knowledge. This is the composition of Krishna's form, even when he's in the form of a hog. He's not a hog. He's Krishna. He's Vishnu. He's the object of the Vedas. He is the one that the all Shastra, all scriptures, all sacrifice is meant to please. He is that person. And therefore, very soon, the great sages are going to offer him prayers. They are going to take all Vedic knowledge and compress it and speak it for the pleasure of this Supreme Lord, and even though he is in the form of a hog. So we cannot take, if we want to enter into this mysterious pastime, which will end in Vaikuntha, actually. It ends in Vaikuntha. This is one of the most wonderful parts of the Bhagavatam, actually. It ends in Vaikuntha. If we want to enter into this very mysterious pastime, we have to accept that Krishna, for his own purposes, for his own reasons, Krishna has come in this mood, in this form, and is completely transcendental. And it is wonderful. It is wonderful. It fills us with wonder. And effulgent and beautiful and attractive like anything, even though it's a form of a hog. But it's not. He's not completely transcendental, ecstatically transcendental. So here's a translation. When Brahma was deliberating with his sons, the Supreme Personality of Godhead Vishnu roared tumultuously like a great mountain. Please repeat. While Brahma was deliberating, what does deliberating mean?
Thinking,
but not just thinking.
Meditating about
it. Yeah. Yeah, trying to understand deeply and meditating on what is there a synonym for deliberating?
Contemplating.
Yeah, it means deeply thinking.
Evaluating.
Evaluating. Yeah, that's an accountant's word for it. So, please repeat. While Brahma was deliberating with his sons, the Supreme Personality of Godhead Vishnu
roared tumultuously
like a great mountain. And here's Srila Prabhupada's very short purport. It appears that great hills and mountains also have their roaring power, because they are also living entities. And actually, one time when Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada was in New York, the devotees took him to Gita Nagari, the farm community, which was maybe 5 hours from New York City. And at that time, the devotees used to travel, they had their own buses that were temples, the deities in the temples. And the bus, it was organized like that. And the devotees would travel from city to city and distribute books and things like that. So they took Prabhupada on one of these buses from New York to Gita Nagari. And there was one mountain they passed on the way. And Prabhupada said, "This one is alive." Like that. He pointed to this one. Because in the Puranas it's described how Indra was the enemy. He's known as the enemy of the mountains
because the mountains used to have wings. And when you have wings, naturally you fly. And when you fly, especially if you're as heavy as a mountain, you have to land. And the mountains were indiscriminate where they landed, and they happened to land on people and houses and things like that. So Indra became upset with them, so he cut off their wings. So there was an enmity, some anger, animosity between the mountains and the and Indradev. And therefore, Indradev became also angry at Giriraj, Govardhan. But after this point, after Krishna lifted Giriraj Govardhan and all the residents of Vrindavan underneath Giriraj Govardhan for shelter, and after Indradev understood and how Giriraj describes in Ananda Vrindavan Sampradaya, how Indra was throwing thunderbolt after thunderbolt at Giriraj. He was using all his powers to cause harm to the residents of Vrindavan and Giriraj. And how was Giriraj feeling at this time? He didn't even notice, because he was captivated by the fragrance of Krishna's breath going in and out as Krishna was holding up the mountain. He was so ecstatic being in touch with Krishna in that way that he didn't even notice the thunderbolts that were striking him. So at that time, the enmity between Indradev and the mountains ended. So, although it may surprise us, mountains have their roaring power because they are also living entities, but they don't, by the mercy of Indra, have their flying power. The volume of the sound vibrated is proportionate to the size of the material body. When Brahma was guessing about the appearance of the Lord's incarnation as a boar, the Lord confirmed Brahma's contemplation by roaring with his gorgeous voice. Not like... It doesn't sound like that exactly. Something, but not quite. We'll read the next verse. What's going on here? Okay, now I know what's going on. Tell them to call back later. Okay, it's not yours. Tell them you're busy in the Bhagavatam class now, okay? Next verse. The omnipotent Supreme Personality of Godhead enlivened Brahma and the other highly elevated Brahmanas by again roaring with his uncommon voice, which echoed in all directions. Purport. Brahma and the other enlightened Brahmanas who know the Supreme Personality of Godhead are enlivened by the appearance of the Lord in any of his multi-incarnations. The appearance of the wonderful and gigantic incarnation of Krishna, of Vishnu, as the mountain-like boar, did not fill them with any kind of fear. Although the Lord's resounding voice was tumultuous and echoed horribly in all directions as an open threat to all demons who might challenge his omnipotency. So he let the demon who happened to be Hiranyaksha, who had thrown the earth down into the lower sphere, he let him know, I am here. Because his voice had so much potency. It was transcendental. It was not of this world. He let them know, I am here. You want to fight? Okay. Like Kamsa. Krishna let Kamsa know in so many ways that I am here. He killed the washerman then broke the bow. And you know, in the Gaga Samhita, it's described how that bow, you know this pastime of Krishna? How the killing of Kamsa? Everyone knows that pastime, yes? You know it? You know it? You don't know how Krishna killed Kamsa? Krishna killed Kamsa. You know? You know, before Krishna killed Kamsa, a little earlier, he went into the, there was a Dhanajagya going on. There was a bow sacrifice. And using that as an excuse, we're having a big sacrifice. And therefore, we're going to have a big festival. And in this festival, we're going to have a wrestling match. And Kamsa had Akura invite Krishna to come to the wrestling match. So his real reason for having Krishna come was not to see Krishna wrestle, but was to have him killed. You know that, yes? Yes? So Krishna, so another thing that Kamsa did to make sure that Krishna would come is that he imprisoned Vasudeva and Devaki, because he knew that Krishna would have to come to rescue them. So when Krishna arrived, one of the first things he did, he killed the washerman. That's a whole wonderful pastime. But then when he went into the great arena where the bow was, and the bow was huge. I can't remember the size at this moment, but perhaps 70, I can't have to translate it, maybe 25 meters in length. This bow was the bow of Lord Shiva. But how did Lord Shiva get the bow? It was given to him by Lord Vishnu. And how did Kamsa get the bow? When Kamsa had a benediction, because in his previous life, who knows who Kamsa was in his previous life? Kalanimi, yes. A demon who was fighting, described in the churning, after the churning of the ocean of milk. And Vishnu killed him. But he was brought back to life, and then he performed some great austerities, similar to the ones that Hiranyakashipu performed. And he got a benediction that he could not be killed, practically speaking, by any demigod. So he went on a mission. This was in his life as Kamsa. And he was conquering. All the demons who he used to fight with Krishna, who Krishna killed, they were all his allies, because he would approach different powerful persons and say, let us fight. And if I beat you, if I defeat you, then I will be your servant. But if I defeat you, you will be my servant. And if you defeat me, I will be your servant. Okay? And they would say, okay. And then he would defeat them one by one by one. And then at one point, he went to the mountain where Pasaram was. And he was so powerful, Kamsa was. And he lifted up the mountain and put it down. He lifted up the mountain and put it down. He lifted up the mountain again and he disturbed Pasaram, who came down in an angry mood. And Pasaram looked at him, so powerful, and said, you are like a mosquito and I will crush you. Because he didn't like his pride, and he saw it as a Kshatriya's pride. And Pasaram, if you've read the Bhagavatam, he didn't like Kshatriyas very much. You are a Kshatriya and I will crush you like a mosquito. And Kamsa said, I'm not a Kshatriya. I'm a Rakshasa. And this is, if you know the actual history of, he wasn't actually the son of of Ugrasena. Anyway, get some complicated details. So when he heard that he wasn't a Kshatriya, Pasaram said, okay. He was pleased with him. And he showed him this bow that Lord Shiva had given him, that Vishnu had given to Lord Shiva, and said, if you could string this bow, you can take it and you will become so powerful. But if you fail to string it, 25 meters long, you will die. Kamsa went to it and he strung it. And then Pasaran told him, okay, but whoever is powerful enough to break this bow of Lord Shiva, he will be your death. So when Krishna came to Mathura, he went to the place where this bow was. And Kamsa, with his spies, had already heard that he had killed the washerman. And then he walked into the Dhanajagya, the place, the arena, and there were so many soldiers there protecting the bow. And Krishna walked over, and they said, you cannot come into this area. And Krishna said, really? He didn't say really, but he walked right in, he took the bow, and he broke it. And the sound of that bow was heard by Kamsa, and it cracked his heart. But still, he was such a stubborn person that he wouldn't release Devaki and Vasudeva. He wouldn't go to Krishna and say, Krishna, I'm sorry. I didn't really mean to kill your eight brothers before. I didn't. Listen, everyone makes mistakes. Please forgive me. If he would have bowed down, then Kamsa would have forgiven him. Krishna would have forgiven him immediately. He said, okay. But he was such a stubborn demon that despite Krishna telling him in so many ways, killing of the washerman, then later on the killing of Kumalaya Pita, then the killing of Chanur, Mastika, Sala, Tosala, and still, he was determined to be averse an enemy of Krishna and not surrender. Despite Krishna so many times letting him go, Kamsa is so foolish. But I'm even more foolish because Krishna lets me know so many ways, so many times, and still turn our back. It's so foolish. The resounding voice of Varaha was tumultuous and echoed horribly in all directions as an open threat to all demons who might challenge his omnipotency. What does omnipotency mean? Say it. All powerful. How powerful is all powerful?
Inconceivably.
Inconceivably powerful, but how powerful is that? That means that a universe, you look up at night and see the stars in the sky, you look at the ocean and see how vast it is. This is nothing for Krishna. Mama Angsa Teja Sambha. It's nothing for Krishna. And Krishna is inconceivable. He's omnipotent. All power is his. Even the power that we have, even the power that the other people have, and even the power that demons have, it's all Krishna's power.
And the art of Krishna's consciousness is to use Krishna's power in the service of Krishna. And we are also Krishna Shakti Paraprokta Chetra Gyakya Tatapara. We should use, we are Krishna's, that's how we began this class, that we are Krishna's, and everything else is Krishna's, and if we can just ourselves use ourself and everything else in Krishna's service, then we become happy, and the material world actually will become like the spiritual. Okay, I wanted to actually read the next verse, but there's something very special in it. But I won't need that for another person, soul who gets to read the Bhagavatam. Thank you very much, Hare Krishna. Any questions or comments? Maybe we can open the door. Let a little air in. Thank you. Yes.
Mountains flying and speaking is quite contrary to what we're taught in school.
Well, obviously you went to the wrong school. I mean, your phone can speak to you. Your computer speaks to you. You can speak to your help. If you're all, if you use a Nexus, you say, "Okay, Google, this is what I want you to do." Okay, Siri. Yes, it is contrary to what we're taught.
If we analyze what Prabhupada's saying in the Bhagavatam and what Krishna's saying in the Bhagavad Gita, then we can understand that actually it's quite challenging.
What's quite challenging?
What Prabhupada's saying, what the Vedas are teaching us, challenges the established norms of seeing the creation and seeing the universe in a way that we're taught to see from a very external platform. So this can be quite challenging for us as individuals.
Yes. We spoke about this point yesterday because we spoke about the point that God came from the nostril of, because we mentioned that generally what comes from our nostrils is something of a different quality. So of all places to come from, and he comes in the form of a boar, no less. So what to speak of mountains flying? So we spoke a bit about this point yesterday. A point that I didn't mention, this is not the essence of the Bhagavatam, though. These details, in one sense, that challenge our view of reality. But our view of reality is only a view of reality. If there is an automobile accident and 15 people witness it, generally, if you ask them what happened, you'll get 15 different opinions of what happened. And each one of them will consider what they see as real. This is what happened. If you have a fight with someone, if you have an argument with someone, this is usually the point of, this is the problem that one person is seeing. He'll tell you what you did, what it was like from his point of view, what he really saw, and another person will tell you what he saw, and then we argue about it. So who actually sees reality as it is? If one studies a little bit of quantum physics, one of the principles of quantum physics is that the observer influences what is seen. So if you're looking at something, makes it act differently. So where are you going to find objective reality in that? So who actually, you follow what I mean? The observer affects how the thing that is observed reacts. Basic quantum laws, at least on a quantum level. So what is actually reality? So this particular question, this doesn't directly answer your question in one sense, but it talks about the broader question, who actually can say, I know reality as it is? The scientists can't say that, and we are believers in what the scientists tell us, like there are black holes, etc. What are black holes? How would someone describe any? How would you describe what a black hole is?
I have a theory.
Huh?
I have a theory.
What is it? What is a black hole in theory?
It's one of the pores of Mahavishnu's skin.
No, that's not what they say. The scientists. You learn that in the Gurukula, not in the Asurakula. Black hole, at least everyone knows that a black hole is this, can't call it a thing, but all of matter compresses and goes into it as a singularity, and then what happens? What happens when it goes into a black hole? Does anyone know? Do you know? Well, no one knows. But there's something that everything goes into, and then.
Ceases to exist.
No, you don't even know it ceased to exist, or it doesn't cease to exist. They have no idea. So, but yet, they talk about this kind of a thing, as if it's reality, and it's reality in 100 years. People will see it differently. But they talk about it if it's reality, so one has to have so much faith, in fact. I mean, as much faith as you have to have in mountains flying, that something enters into something, and then it doesn't go anywhere. I mean, one has to have faith. So the scientific viewpoint and the viewpoint we learn in school is a viewpoint. And a viewpoint means if you view something from a point, it will look like this. And if you view it from another point, it will look differently. Like if I look at the microphone and have from a viewpoint and I'm seeing something different than when you're looking at it. Everyone from different viewpoints. So who actually knows reality as it is? It means only a person who looks at everything from every viewpoint. And that there's only one person who knows everything as it is, and that's Krishna. He knows reality. So to define reality without a reference to Krishna, which is the conclusion of one very important chapter in the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam, is not reality. To define reality, to think you know reality, what really is, without seeing Krishna in it, the absolute truth, you're not seeing reality. This is the conclusion of the Hansa Avatar to the four Kumaras. So, how do we, practically speaking, deal with the doubts that come to us when we read things in the Bhagavatam that go against our conditioned responses to them? That's basically the question. So the first answer is, if we don't accept my viewpoint, because I happen to have been learned in a particular way that this is actually true,
How many of you, when you were in the second grade or third grade, learned that all matter is made up of atoms? Did you learn this? When did you learn that? Grade five. This is made out of atoms. And what are atoms made out of? What are atoms made out of? You know, you're going to fail third grade science. What are atoms made out of?
Neutrons,
protons, and electrons. Now, there's no scientist in the world who thinks that atoms are made out of neutrons, protons, and electrons. But all of us believe it, because that's what we learned in the third grade. And I remember one time reading in the second canto of the Bhagavatam that matter is mostly ether. Ether means basically space. And I remembered, and then I thought, now how am I going to, and I dealt with this just like, my conditioned mind began doubting it. How is this mostly space? Maybe this is mostly space. How is this mostly space? But then I remembered what I had learned in the third grade in science, that this is composed out of atoms, and atoms are mostly the distance between the thing in the middle again? The nucleus. The nucleus and the electrons is mostly space, and this is composed of matter, atoms, so this is mostly composed of space. And then I remembered, that's not even true, because no one believes that. But I was happy then, because I had a way that my third grade mind could understand it. I had to put it through that type of a process to accept what the Bhagavatam said, that matter is mostly ether, even though I knew that it wasn't true, the way that I had learned it. But it took that type of illusory thinking to pacify the mind. But a better way of thinking would have been to just say, oh, the Bhagavatam says this, okay. So that's one way to answer your question. There's lots of other ways to answer the question. Another way was how Prabhupada answered a similar question, sitting right on that seat. And he gave a class in this very place. He was sitting right there, and the devotees were sitting right here. And so we are sitting. And he explained how there are giant eagles that fly from planet to planet, and they hatch their eggs through the atmospheric friction, the heat coming from the friction when the eggs land in the atmosphere. Okay, there's flying mountains, there's giant eagles, there's singing mountains. Were you here?
No.
I think they eat elephants too. So there was a room full of young boys and girls who all went to third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade science, and probably everyone in the room went. And then after the class, Prabhupada said, "Are there any questions?" And one person only, sitting perhaps right over there, raised his hand and said, in your class, Prabhupada, you mentioned that there are giant eagles that fly from planet to planet. It is a little hard to believe. And we all went. Especially when Prabhupada was sitting on the Vyasa Sangha. he was, especially then, he was the founder acharya of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. His duty was to present the philosophy as it was, to preach Srimad Bhagavatam, to defend. He was a lion. So that devotee asked Prabhupada that question. And Prabhupada's reply was very short. He said, "What do you know? You are still within the womb of your mother." No one left. Just by the way. At least I didn't laugh. So our fault, greatest fault, is our arrogance, our pride. And we think our view is reality, and it's only view from a point. And we always perceive things. Reality is that we perceive things according to our consciousness. When our consciousness is very, very dull and we're angry, everything everyone does is wrong. That's the mode of ignorance. So the purer our consciousness is, the more accurately we perceive reality. So therefore, the lifestyle and the rules and regulations that we are asked to follow is all having to do with purifying the consciousness so we can see reality more clearly. And reality means ultimately to see Krishna. And if we're not seeing Krishna, we're not seeing accurately, completely. We're not seeing reality. So that's the Vaishnava conclusion. And now we are all in the womb of our mother and work in the material nature. This is actually something that Brahma actually says to Krishna, that I'm like a baby in the womb of the material energy. So like a child in the womb will always kick the mother, and the mother doesn't take offense. So please don't take what I've done offensively. So we are like, our vision is, so we should be a little humble, a little less arrogant, chant Hare Krishna, pray to their lordships for help, and serve the devotees, and depend on the mercy of Krishna. Hare Krishna. Go take prasadam. And take prasadam. Go. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Sisi Gonitai ki jai. Sisi Radhabalava ki jai. Sisi Jagannath Baladev Subhadra Devi ki jai. Srila Prabhupada Bhaktavinda ki jai. Nitai Gopi.
Jai.
And where does it go? No one knows.